It's Tuesday, November 30, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Foreign policy issues again dominate the news this Tuesday morning, and for good reason. The biggest news comes out of Asia, where a rift between China and North Korea portends huge changes on the international scene. For the last half century, the People's Republic of China and the Hermit Kingdom of North Korea have had a close but rather awkward alliance. There has been an alliance of dictatorships of communist nations that have been drawn together by mutual need, mutual fear, and mutual enemies. But now China, entering the world as a resurgent power, has to recognize that North Korea, the Hermit Kingdom acting in a most erratic and nearly insane way, is a larger danger to itself than has ever been the case from South Korea. In other words, all of a sudden, China is beginning to make noise about the possibility of unifying North and South Korea. Now, what is going on here? Well, for one thing, we see China not only worried about international respect in a whole new way, but worried about its own domestic stability. We see China acting in its own best interest, following a rational choice theory understanding of international relations that predicts that a nation will act in ways that it sees long-term in its own best interests. North Korea had looked to China as its protector state, but now North Korea has to be getting the message loudly and clearly. When leaked cables from China indicate a change in China's disposition toward North Korea, we have to assume several things. First, we have to assume that these leaked cables were probably not entirely leaked by accident. In all likelihood, China is sending Pyongyang a very clear signal. At the same time, China is sending a signal internationally. It does not want to be associated with the rogue and irrational behavior of the North Korean dictatorship. That's good news. Long term, one of the biggest issues for China's future is how it will relate not only to its neighbors there on the Yellow Sea, but how it will relate to the international world of civilized nations. China is now a full member of the United Nations, of course, and a member of the UN Security Council, but full respect has not yet been accorded to China because of its own rather mysterious understanding of its foreign policy postures. Well, that's beginning to change, and China is beginning to act more like a normal nation. Now, this doesn't mean that China is necessarily going to be an ally to the West, much less to the United States. China has its own interests. One of the basic presuppositions of international relations is, once again, that nations will make a rational choice about their own long-term stability and interests. China, we can count on making those decisions in terms of its own interests. Right now, the big news must be landing in Pyongyang that China is no longer seeing an alliance with North Korea as in its best interest, not only for the present, but for the future. That means big changes for North Korea and likely changes for the entire Korean Peninsula. What kind of plan could lead to a reunification? Well, there's the rub. There is, at this point, no feasible plan for that reunification so long as the totalitarian dictatorship now in power in North Korea continues. But this is a sign that perhaps without Chinese sponsorship and protection, the days of that dictatorship may come to an end. The other big foreign policy story has to do with the WikiLeaks release of more than 250,000 diplomatic cables and information units from the United States. These were purloined, stolen by espionage, and now, with cooperation of the international media, they're being spread abroad. Now, this will lead to diplomatic ramifications. It will harm, in some sense, the diplomatic relations of the United States, because with the release of this kind of information, it's not only the sending state that is at stake in terms of the exposure, but the receiving state as well. So there are a good number of foreign nations who are also implicated in the release of these documents. Some embarrassment has already happened. Embarrassment to some Arab nations, such as Kuwait, which apparently had given advice to the United States that it would not want its Arab and Muslim state neighbors to see. But something else is also becoming evident. The leaked materials indicate that American diplomacy is pretty much being developed along the lines that responsible diplomacy should be expected to follow. In other words, even though there is some interesting material here, very little of it is genuinely shocking. And in terms of diplomacy and how diplomacy should be done in the arrangement of relations between nations, this looks pretty much just the way we would expect it to look. So, oddly enough, whatever the intent of WikiLeaks in terms of releasing this data, it may in the end serve as much to comfort as to concern. That brings me to another very current story that has the media largely looking at itself, doing a bit of introspection. Over the past week or so, there has been a barrage of stories dealing with the Transportation Safety Administration and its security procedures in terms of scans and pat-downs. There was a call on the day before Thanksgiving for a basic strike of American flyers against this practice in the name of American liberty and freedom. But what happened? Well, the story is the story that didn't happen. The much-hyped National Opt-Out Day just never happened. It didn't occur. Americans by the millions went to airports, went through the security lines, got on planes, and by and large got where they were going, both in terms of arriving at their holiday destination and arriving back home. I also boarded a plane this holiday weekend on the very last day of the weekend, one of the busiest flying days of the year, and when I got to the airport, I discovered just what I feared, a horrendously long security line. I braced myself for the inevitable, and that was a delay, indeed, perhaps even if the visual cues were of any accuracy, missing my flight. But it didn't happen. Instead, I need to acknowledge that the TSA officials made the line move expeditiously, and everyone acted professionally. And not only was there not an opt-out day, there was absolutely, at least to my observation, no protest whatsoever, but instead, a rather general appreciation for the professionalism of the TSA. Now, what happened? How did this story happen, and then the opt-out day that was so heavily hyped not occur at all? Well, interestingly, the New York Times addresses that issue. David Carr, in his column The Media Equation, comes to the conclusion that the major media were largely listening to themselves. They were also listening to the internet chatter. He writes, "If a squadron of mad scientists surrounded by supercomputers gathered in a laboratory to try to conjure a single news topic that would blow up large, they could not touch the TSA pat-down story." But he goes on and says, "It didn't happen. Cue the media mushroom cloud," he says. "By last Tuesday, there were print reports about the new scanning technology, heavy-breathing blog posts about the government using the technology to alter or gather DNA, and every cable channel featured wall-to-wall speculation about what would happen when people got into the airport on Wednesday and how many would be carrying lanterns and pitchforks." Well, it didn't happen. As he writes, in the real world, nothing happened. Now, this gets to the very real distinction between pseudo-news and actual news. Daniel Boorstin, the late former Librarian of Congress, spoke of pseudo-events and real events. And in modern America, he suggested, given our hyped entertainment culture, it was sometimes difficult for citizens to know the difference between the real and the unreal. If events are presented as being almost real, many Americans assume that they are. Well, it turns out that the same thing is true with news reports. Now, one of the interesting things I want us to note is that a major news source such as the New York Times has gone back to the story and has acknowledged in a very prominent column that it too was caught up in this hysteria, but nothing happened. There is a certain amount of honesty we need to recognize when a major media source says, "We drank the Kool-Aid, and now we know better. We went along with the media swarm, and now we're ready to call ourselves on it." Speaking of the media, there's another interesting story out there. In just recent days, we discovered that Slate.com, one of the earliest of the online news magazines, has basically never been making money, or, according to some reports, might now finally, some 15 or so years later, be making some money. It's hard to actually tell, but this much is clear. It didn't turn out to be a major media revenue producer. Now there's the story in the Wall Street Journal yesterday suggesting that Salon.com, which appeared along the same time as Slate.com back in about 1995, is exploring opportunities to merge with or be acquired by another media company. As Russell Adams writes for the Wall Street Journal, this is an acknowledgement of the perilous economics of running a freestanding online news organization. Now, what Salon.com is looking for is a major media conglomerate patron, someone to take it within its larger umbrella that would include print, probably at a minimum, along with a likely presence in terms of the broadcast media as well. Now, the reason for this is quite simple. There isn't enough ad revenue online to make this stand on its own. $15 million has been lost, according to one source here, and that just in the last 5 years. A third of that came, according to Mr. Adams, in the fiscal year that ended March 31, 2010. Now, one of the things we should note in all of this is that the much-hyped move of information to the internet has not been accompanied by an equal move of advertising revenue. Is that due to the economic recession? Well, undoubtedly that's playing a part. Advertisers simply aren't throwing around the kind of cash and advertising accounts that they had in the past. But it also says something about how advertisers are wary of leaving the old media for the new. We're going to find here exactly what happens when the viewers are in advance of the advertisers, the readers in advance of those that are placing the ads. You have to wonder how much of this is generational. Maybe those who are looking at old media are the ones who also have old money. Keep that in mind when you consider the story that appeared in the Minneapolis newspaper on Monday, suggesting that the new huge and very, very hungry market for e-readers such as the Kindle are older readers. As Bill Ward writes, for those of advanced age, largely those who are stereotypically slow to embrace technology, the advancement of the e-reader is a perfect fit. There are many reasons for this. One of them is the fact that there is scalable type. The reader can change the size of the type, something you cannot do in a printed book. Now, it's really interesting when you look at this because this comes even as there are reports that among the reading public, 21% indicate that they own an e-reader. And about the sales of these e-readers, get this. In 2010, over the Christmas season, it is expected that an estimated 6.4 million e-reader units will be sold. Just 2 years ago, there were only 580,000. By any measure, that is an incredible market shift. Finally, I want to draw attention to a column in the New York Times by Nicholas D. Kristof. I've often had to take issue with Mr. Kristof, especially with his secularist arguments, but he writes some very good material on moral issues that are often hidden, on the margins, especially of American and international cultures. He writes in Sunday's edition of the New York Times about forced slavery and prostitution in the United States. It's a very moving story having to do with a college graduate who says that she spent 3 years terrorized by those who organized a brothel in Midtown Manhattan. She was brought from Korea in the promises of a career, but found herself instead blackmailed into service as a prostitute. What Mr. Kristof is describing and exposing in his column is the explosion of sex trafficking, which has spread across the United States, largely in immigrant communities, but is also one of the major issues of moral concern worldwide. If that is off of your screen, you need to look not only at Mr. Kristof's column, but at what's going on in your own community, where it just may be that slavery is not just a thing of the past, but very much of the present. This is something that should have every Christian's concern. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmoeller. Please mark your calendar for Recalibrate, the 2011 Annual Collegiate Conference at Southern Seminary. It's going to be February 11th through 12, 2011, and is going to bring many people to our campus, including our special guest, my friend, C.J. Mahaney. Dr. Russell Moore and I will also be speaking. It's going to be a big event. It's especially for college students, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the Southern Seminary campus, February 11th through 12, 2011, for Recalibrate. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information about Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.